Welcome to the JPGN Journal Club, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely and Dr. Jake Mann.
Happy holidays, everybody. Here's JPGN Journal Club, led by Dr. Jake Mann. Don't forget ESPGHAN's other educational offerings, though. https://www.espghan.org/knowledge-center, where you can find information about the GI Winter School on the 15th of January, the Monothematic Conference on Steatotic Liver Disease in Children on the 30th of January, and February seems to be taking a break, on the 5th of March, the GI Immunology Masterclass, From Pathogenesis to Clinical Management of EGID, Celiac Disease, and IBD. Jake, you've chosen for us today a decade of real-world clinical experience with 8-week azithromycin-metronidazole combined therapy in pediatric Crohn's disease from JPGN, written by Fioretti and others in Edinburgh, and Failure to Rescue Pediatric Recipients of Living Donor Liver Transplantation, a single-center study of technical complications in 500 primary grafts from Brussels by the team of, I will botch this, I'm almost certain, Khanaoui and others. Tell us why you thought these were the cream of the crop this month.
Thanks, Alex. Well, I thought that different treatments for IBD are important, and there is, on one end of the spectrum, huge work going into biologics and the novel biologics and the trials that sort of are coming through predominantly in adult medicine and then trickling their way down eventually into pediatrics. And that's really targeted on the children with more difficult to treat disease, the more severe end of the spectrum, those who usually have failed first-line therapy. And then this is really looking almost at the opposite end of the spectrum. So children who have more mild disease, what are the other options that they can give, where perhaps it would be or felt that there's, you don't need to go in with the full heavy-handed approach of huge immunosuppression, but then exclusive enteral nutrition, EEN, is not seen to be the right option. So I thought it was interesting to understand a bit more about this. It's not something that I'm familiar with. The Edinburgh Centre is internationally recognised as a centre of excellence for IBD. So I thought that was a good paper to discuss.
Fair enough. But there are two alternatives to antibiosis as, call it, an induction therapy in mild or moderate inflammatory bowel disease, if I remember right, corticosteroids, and what you already mentioned, parenteral alimentation. With the exception of the side effects to be expected from corticosteroid therapy, they're each as good as the other, are they not?
Yeah, correct. That's the result of several very large studies and meta-analyses, including real-world data, shows that corticosteroid induction or exclusive enteral nutrition have very good risk. Well, depends on your definition, very good. They have highly efficacious clinical remission rates, somewhere between 70 and 90%. Now, as you say, the real kicker is the side effects and or the burden of treatment. Now, the burden of treatment really from the exclusive enteral nutrition perspective is the psychological and physical stress that comes with having only liquid diet in a group of individuals who are predominantly at adolescents, teenagers, not necessarily that palatable at all, and they may well want to eat food. So that's why it's not tolerated in a large number of individuals. And then on the other hand, corticosteroids has their well-known catalogue of side effects, And for various reasons, some people do not want to try that in the first instance. So I guess this gives an alternative.
Not a lot of such kids, it seems to me, because in a decade, the Edinburgh team were able to pull up only 44 children given azithromycin and metronidazole. Among those 44, after 8 weeks of the course, 64%, or 28 children, had entered remission. We have then 38 who completed the treatment. 6 couldn't tolerate it. That's 28 out of 38 is 74%. 74%, not a bad result. But we don't know, because the authors haven't told us, what their luck is with either total parenteral alimentation or with corticosteroids. There is no alternative presented in terms of results to antibiotic two-agent therapy. I think that's a defect in the paper.
You could look at it two ways. You could say that, yes, they have not given the direct head-to-head comparison of, within this centre, these are the results of clinical remission on patients with corticosteroid or enteral nutrition induction in mild, moderate Crohn's disease. However, this is a real-world study, meaning that this is outside of clinical trials. There's no randomization. There is something that influenced the decision for these treatment options. And therefore, even if you were to present data showing these are the patients who had steroid induction, these are the ones who had antibiotic induction, and these are their differences, well, there will be something inherently different about those groups that led to those choices in the first place. And I suppose my feeling would be that if you saw a child who looked more sick, they had more raised inflammatory markers, worse inflammation on scope, then you probably would lean more towards steroid induction. If they were very malnourished, you would probably try and encourage them more towards exclusive enteral nutrition or steroids. But if you found a child who was slightly more robust, but they did have a histological diagnosis of Crohn's disease, then you could say, well, let's give the antibiotic therapy a go. And of course, we don't have the granularity of the exact decision-making on an individual patient level, but I think that whilst, yes, there is no direct comparison with the other treatment options, even if there were, that could be misleadingly reassuring as a direct comparison.
All points taken, and yet I think that to have presented this one acknowledgedly skilled center's results with those two alternatives and to say these are the reasons that we had to choose double agent antibiotic therapy, always with the caveat your mileage may differ, that would have made a richer, deeper paper.
Agreed, yeah. And I think that, and also a discussion of, I would be interested in to what extent it was patient and family choice that influenced these decisions on the borderline cases,
rather than frank medical need. Again, a point well taken. Well, families can be difficult. If anybody there listening wants to write that down, but I think we all know it already. Let's move along toward an article that I think... Jake, take the wheel.
Sorry to interrupt. There's one other thing that I wanted to kind of mention about this paper. It conceptually is interesting that inflammatory bowel disease can be treated with antibiotic therapy without any primary inflammatory, anti-inflammatory agent or immunosuppressive agent. We know that inflammatory bowel disease can be driven by defects in the epithelial lining and defects in the immune system based on genetics. So it is not exclusively driven by the gut microbiota, even though many of these patients have gut dysbiosis. But in spite of that, here we've demonstrated that there is a subset of patients who do respond to manipulation of their gut microbiome. And I think that that is conceptually interesting.
3/4 of the patients that actually completed the course of therapy. Fair enough. And thank you for bringing up that point. We now move on, though, to the article from Pediatric Transplantation from Brussels that introduced me to a new term, failure to rescue. Well, in severe liver disease, without liver transplantation, all patients die. That is a definitive failure to rescue. Liver transplantation is an attempt at rescue. And the group in Brussels use the term here to mean when a complication of the liver transplantation attempt at rescue supervenes, when that complication is not successfully treated, and when it ends in death or graft loss, a failure to rescue has occurred. The authors examined rates of death and of graft loss at 1 and 5 years after living donor liver transplantation in 500 children. They tallied instances of arterial, venous, and biliary tract complications, and then counted up the numbers of deaths and graft losses that could be ascribed to such complications. As I think will be the case everywhere, biliary tract complications were most numerous. But arterial complications led to the most deaths and graft losses. The article contains page after page of etiologies of liver disease and age at liver transplantation and surgical technique. But even if you read that all through carefully rather than skimming over it, as the temptation to do will be great, I must say, the authors do not speculate on how the etiologies of liver disease, the age at liver transplantation, and the surgical technique contribute to failure to rescue. Instead, their conclusions are, written in milk, rather general. Suggestions are put forward for avoiding arterial and venous complications, but not biliary tract complications. And in an almost wistful summing up, they comment that failure to rescue analyses may hold promise for better clinical care. Well, they might, but isn't the idea of failure to rescue really just a new bottle for old wine? Somehow, speaking from the perspective of 70 years, 50 of it in medicine, I remember morbidity and mortality conferences, and they seem to have done much the same business as failure to rescue analyses are put forward as doing now. Well, there's a grumpy old man's take on this article, Jake, and please tell me that I'm wrong and point out how.
It's a new term for me too, and it was one of my esteemed colleagues who highlighted this to me, and I thought, well, let's look and see what people have written about failure to rescue. And so I thought that this would be a interesting lead-in to this terminology and see what use it has, particularly coming from the Brussels group, who have enormous experience in living donor liver transplantation. 500 primary grafts is a substantial number. Of course, this is over a reasonable time period, all the way from 93 to 22. So there is evolution of their surgical technique in there. The other caveat that I must say is that I obviously am not qualified to make any comments about surgical technique at all. I have a very superficial understanding of the details, but it is relevant to our clinical practice, and I think therefore it's worthy of discussion. The terminology failure to rescue, I suppose it doesn't to me necessarily, it isn't necessarily immediately intuitive as to what it means. You could, I suppose, describe what is the mortality rate of hepatic artery complications post living transplant, living donor liver transplantation, which I guess is a bit more of a mouthful, but that's sort of what it means, for example, and you take each complication individually and figure out what its mortality rate and graft loss rate is.
But and Chief, we're too tender-hearted nowadays to use the word mortality.
Perhaps that's what it is. Perhaps that it is that we don't want to face up to the nasty M words. I guess I thought it was a useful illustration of, you know, really clearly hepatic artery thrombosis is less common but has got bad mortality with, in this group, nearly 28% of mortality for patient and 21% failure to graft rescue. Whereas biliary complications are much more common but very rarely a cause of mortality, and at least the anastomotic biliary strictures also not a cause of graft loss. So I guess it is a way of illustrating the fact that these are highly complex specialized surgeries in extremely fragile patients, and complications will happen. So that, there's the argument, do you really call a biliary anastomotic stricture a complication if it happens in 20%, even in the best surgeons in the world? So it's just an expected part of the procedure, really. So that drawing attention to the fact that management of these complications is the key. I agree that they haven't necessarily explained a huge amount on ways to divert the outcome or change the outcome. They refer to several other papers that the groups have published on, for example, management of the portal vein, anastomotic strictures, artery thrombosis, and so forth, and broadly say these are the things that should be done more and or better.
Well, I think we can all agree, our motto being pro bono contra malum, that things should be done better when at all possible. But to shift metaphors, how are we going to get the bell around the neck of the gosh darn cat?
I guess you could take one take-home message from this would be that absolutely focus on hepatic artery thrombosis on the basis that even though it is rare, it is so devastating as a complication. That should be your primary focus. Of course, don't ignore portal vein and biliary complications, but in terms of patient outcome, that is the most severe when calculated this way. That would be one take home.
Okay.
But there are many patient factors going into it, and these surgeons are very experienced, and then they are considering this already. So incremental advances are challenging.
Fair enough. Jake, when a surgeon shows me an article and recommends that I read it, my back fur goes up because I anticipate that she will ask me to go back and engage in a complicated set of case reviews in order to write the same article using our single institution experience. Is there anything like that in the background of your being introduced to this paper?
No, it was actually a medical hepatologist who highlighted this as a concept that that we both became newly familiar with and just thought it'd be interesting to read and chat about. So I think I'm pleased to have been introduced to this. I'm not sure I would necessarily choose to do my own failure to rescue analysis, but it is a useful lens to look through, perhaps as an added point to this kind of study.
Well, we've looked at it, we've slowed down, and I think we can leave it at the roadside and get on to where we were going, but I look forward to learning how you and failure to rescue as a concept get on in Birmingham.
Thanks.
All right. Listeners out there, we're about to tip over into a new year that, as always, will bring challenges and that, as always, will see losses. I hope that your challenges are successfully dealt with, and I hope that your losses are not too grave. With that, then, Jake, thanks for a good year, and I'll see you in January.
Thanks, Alex.